Episode 11. Welcome to episode 11 of the Thinking Habits podcast. This week is an absolute cracker. One of the best conversations I've had so far with my friend Carl, who describes his journey from his own mental health issues to that of a qualified counsellor working in a similar field that I did in drug and alcohol rehab, but we'll get into that in the interview. It was honest, it was open, it was pragmatic, and above all, it was just really, really interesting. And the hour and a bit that we were talking just flew by in a flash. In fact, we didn't even have time for an intro. We dispense with the intro altogether. We just get straight into it. So without any further ado, I'll see you at the other end, but enjoy this chat with Carl, because I'm sure you will.
Absolutely. So what have you been up to?
I've just finished my studying, just been graduating.
Yeah, fab.
And getting on the register and all that lot for the counselling and the like.
Yeah.
And just changing it, doing it with work now as well.
Wow.
So, that's kind of cool. You know what I mean? Starting to get the counselling with work.
Yeah.
But it's great. Yeah, it's coming together slowly but surely.
Fab. Oh, wicked. Well, that's obviously what we were going to talk about, wasn't it? It was kind of your journey from here to there, isn't it? So.
Yeah. How it started. What got me into wanting to be a counsellor was having counselling myself. Mm. So, I would say I never really thought I had a mental health issue. Mm. For a very long time, I thought I was just all right. It was just normal, you know, going about the thing. And it wasn't until I had counselling, my doctor put me onto it. It wasn't until I had counselling that I thought, wow, what's this? What's this that's going on here? And I had a similar experience to yourself when you said, I sat down, I just started talking to someone, and I thought, I've not really got out to say.
No.
And within 10 minutes, do you know what I mean? I was like, just blurting it all out.
It's just a huge can of worms, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was.
I think, how many times have you had, counselling a couple of times? Or
I've had it twice when I needed it. Mm. And I've also had to have it through my studies as well.
Oh, like a kind of supervision sort of thing?
So, well, to be a counsellor, you have to have mandatory counselling as well to make sure that everything that's gone on for you is dealt with.
So there's not a transference issue or anything like that?
No, it's all about making sure that all the stuff that your clients are going to bring aren't going to start triggering you.
Right, got you.
Make sure that your issues have all been dealt with, and then you're okay to sit and listen to other people's issues.
Fair, and rightly so, yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, so that's all mandatory.
I remember when my first count, I think I mentioned it in the first podcast, actually, when I first had my counselling, I remember going with a series of things that I wanted to talk about that I thought was wrong. And then when I finished that, I felt, oh, right, I've done that, I'll be fine now. Not realising that all that had done was just wallpapered over those bits, and everything else that was actually wrong is still there. And then it was only when the second time when I went on, I went, actually, do you know what? You can have it all. Here it is. This is what's going on.
That was the thing that was the best part of it. When I had my mandatory counselling with, when I was training, when I was studying, I went in and I went, right, because we're going to be looking for what's going to trigger me, here we go. I'll start at the beginning.
Yeah.
And this is what's happened.
Yeah.
And let's see if anything pops up out of that. Do you know what I mean? And that was so, when I'd finished it, kind of my counsellor's hair was blown back, you know
what I mean? Whoa. That Aphex Twin video.
Yeah. It was like, right, okay, I don't even know where to begin with all that stuff.
Jeez.
But I'd gone through a very dark time. When I went to my doctor, and I'd gone through a dark time. I'd tried taking my own life and all sorts. I was really in a very bad place. Mm. So my doctor suggested it, and I tried antidepressants and all that, and they weren't doing much. So I went and I started talking to someone. She was a lovely lady called Rose. Mm. And I sat down with Rose, and she went, so, tell me. Do you know what I mean? I was just like, tell you what? She was going, just tell me. So I just started talking. And before you knew it, Yeah. I was in deep.
That's it. When you find the right one, the second guy I had, Chris, his name was, he didn't do anything apart from just pull a little thread. He just went, right, go on, just pull that. Go with that. Let's see how you go. And then all of a sudden, I'm just unraveling. And it's like a house of cards. It's amazing.
And that's what the good one, that was one of the best things about when I was studying as a counsellor, was doing that. The best counsellors are the ones that say the least.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to, because they just, the odd prompt here and there, a little nudge.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Highlight to them about maybe looking at that. Oh, what's that all about? And before you know it, you're starting digging deeper, and then you're like, oh, God, I didn't realise that was affecting me so badly.
It's especially, I found it especially difficult at first, but intriguing later on when I'm going down something that I think is important, and they give that the lip service, but then they take me back to something innocuous that I said at the beginning and just focus on that for a bit. And I don't even think it's an issue until they go, what about this? What about this thing that happened last Wednesday? I'm like, and all of a sudden that's like the most important. Do you get trained in all that kind of stuff?
The things that you see things, but you've got to try and see where the client's going to take it first. So that's why you've said something, and rather than immediately pounce on it, they've gone, well, let's see where they're taking this.
Yeah, right.
And then they'll go on, and you've got to listen. You don't want to be interrupted with that. So you've got to listen and let them say it. But then if it's something that's still niggling at you, you've got to say, just let's back up a bit. Let me have a look at that a minute. Because that really stood out for me. And I don't know how you feel about it, or whether it's something that isn't registering for you of importance, or whether I'm just getting the wrong end of the stick here. So it's good to rewind it. And sometimes it is innocuous little things. It is the little tiny things that you're not really aware are things that are the big things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or at least they're covering up the big thing.
Is that because you just box them up and box them up and box them up and box them up and they become these big things? Or is it something that I suppose it's a mixture of everything, isn't it? You can repress stuff and you can...
Yeah. Sometimes it's things that you don't... Because you... I don't know how to put it. Of not realising that they are things. Mm. You know what I mean? Little things that you think are everyday life, that everybody has this. Everybody... Mm. Feels crappy doing this, but you don't realise how big an effect it's having on you.
Yeah.
Particularly people that suffer with like social anxiety. Mm. They think everyone gets anxious walking around to shopping and all that. And it's not the case. It can be a little thing like that just, and you can say one little thing that can change it all, the whole perspective of it.
Absolutely.
Why do you think that? Straight away, you think, if that was you, would you be thinking that of people?
Yeah.
No. So why do you think they think that of you?
I found that terrifying when, like, the emotional kind of, the kind of existential barriers that I'd built up to keep myself safe were starting to become a problem for me interacting with people. I became very guarded. I became very insular, but it was something that I felt was justified in the way that, you know, these things have happened to me. I've gone through this, therefore I need this. And then they, like you say, they go one thing and it all just falls down and you go, right, well, that's great. But what am I going to do now? I'm completely naked, vulnerable.
I had an example of that in my first one that I had with Rose, and had the story of it was I'd been attacked, I'd been beaten up and by a gang, it was, by five or six guys, and just out of nowhere, no reason, unprovoked. And I hadn't realised the effect it had had on me, but I'd started stopping going out at night if it was dark, do you know what I mean, if there weren't people around, I'd stay in the house and stuff like that, and I was talking to her, and I hadn't even realised I was doing all of this. Do you know what I mean? I was just thinking, well, I'm just staying in because I choose to stay in, because I was scared of going out.
Yeah.
So I was talking to her about this, and she dug a little deeper in it, and it was that I was scared of being attacked again by a gang. So when I saw five or six lads walking in a group down the road, I'd cross over and go the other way. And so she was quizzing me on it, and she's going, but how many times before you was attacked had you walked past a gang? And I was like, probably loads of times. How many times have you been attacked? Well, once. Why do you think that every gang that you walk past is going to attack you? It was like, I don't know. It's just going, that's it. Because it's happened once, you're keeping it in your mind that to keep myself safe, I've got to do this. I've got to avoid them. I've got to lock myself away. I've got to put this barrier up. That's to keep me safe.
Absolutely.
But really, when she questioned it and went, but how many times has that happened for you in the past? And it kind of, it got me then. And that's what, that was the first hook into counselling of going, I'd never even really questioned these kind of things before. I'd just gone on with it.
So that's really interesting that you went down that route, that you almost got like a kind of checkmate in your own counselling and went, right, I like this. I'm going to, is that how it kind of went? Is that the seed that got...
That was it. And when I'd had it and I went back and I was telling friends of mine about it, because it's very taboo for guys to be in touch with feelings.
Yeah.
So when you go back and you say, I've had counselling and it was great and I was doing that, and they're all like, And I was like, no. And my thought was, I want more men involved in this. I mean, I want to get rid of that taboo of that, because of how good it was for me. I thought, I want to learn how to do it, and I want to get more men coming to counselling. Because all that big boys don't cry and all that lot and stuff and suppressing feelings and don't show emotions and that lot. Well, that's what makes most men a wreck, do you know what I mean? Because they feel they can't tell anyone about it. They can't go down. Women will sit with their friends and they'll all sit there and they'll tell them everything. Men will just sit there and go, whoa.
If you know a good anecdote about the offside rule, Pam knows more about football than I do, so I'm at a loss in situations like that. But you're absolutely right. You know, these new initiatives like the Blurt Foundation and Campaign Against Living Miserably are doing exactly that, aren't they? They're trying to encourage men to talk. But I see that in the prison service. I used to see that a lot, because working as a mental health nurse in a prison, the male mental health nurses wouldn't talk about their mental health, because there's this alpha male bravado culture that just pervades everything, and you have to be stoic and you have to be face forward and chin up.
I can handle anything, me. I'm well hard, and it's like, that's not how it is. Do you know what I mean? That's all you do is you bottle it up and bottle it up and bottle it up, and then you break at some point.
It's got a point, haven't they?
I was thankful that I broke young enough to put things right and to recognise it. Do you know what I mean? The people that are breaking at 60, 70 years old, once they've had the case, they've come out of it and they're like, I wish I'd done this 30 years ago.
Do you
know what I mean? Because I've never felt quite so stable as I do right now. And you think, I want that stigma to go away, and I want more men to be happy to go, yeah, I've been to see a counsellor.
Yeah.
He went really well. I talk my stuff through. Mm-hmm. And if they haven't got somebody to talk to as a family, friends or whatever, then even more reason to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a massive advocate of some kind of therapy. I'm quite tempted to go back in just as a little sense check. You know, it's been a little while. I've not practiced as a frontline nurse for 3.5 years and not had clinical supervision. So it's always nice to get a kind of, you know, like a, check your oil and, you know, get your wheels balanced every now and again.
With the counselling training, they recommend that. They say that you should go every year or two to have personal counselling. On top of your supervision, you have to have clinical supervision every month, at least once a month, depending on how often you're seeing clients. But aside from that, to have your personal thing, just to check in, and as you say, to make sure that the things that you thought were dealt with are still dealt with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because things have a habit of recurring and coming back for you, particularly if you've seen a client that has brought something of your own to the surface. I've had a client that I've sat opposite, and it could have been me I was talking to. Mm-hmm. And that's really difficult then, because you're making sure you keep yourself out of the room.
Yeah.
but you're also thinking, I want to just tell them how I did it. You want to make it more
how I dealt with it.
Oh, I went through that, and this is what I did, and you've got to keep that out, and that's difficult. So that's where supervision is really necessary, to stop that and to check in with that and go, how did that work for me?
That's one of the things that still makes me quite angry about working in the prison service, was that the mental health trust that had the prison service at the time, again, we were supposed to have prison clinical supervision once a month at least, and in an 18-month period I had one. And wow. I was not the only nurse that only had one. And then I went off sick because of the job, came back, and as part of my return to work, I got supervision. That lasted for 3 months, and then it just stopped.
You can't be expecting to deal with people's mental issues and not be able to have your own personal care, because it happens. If I didn't have supervision with counselling, I don't know what would happen. My head would probably explode, because people just come to you and they unload all their issues on you. You absorb them, if you like, and live them while you're with them. And then they leave. And then the next person comes in and you do the same with them.
Yeah.
You'd explode if you're doing that. And particularly in the prisons, I would imagine they're not joyous moments.
They're not at all. And you know, I'm by no means unique in that experience. You know, as a group of nurses, the clinical supervision was limited, if not completely absent. And, you know, I remember my very first day as a mental health nurse, somebody said to me, you can't work with paint and not get splashed. You need to look after yourself.
Yeah.
And that's quite a glib anecdote, but it stuck with me because it was such a simple analogy. And I've come out of one-to-one sessions with patients covered in paint. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And you just think, hang on a minute, I need to take a step back here. And it took me a little while to realise I loved that job, Carl. I absolutely loved that job, but it was not for me.
Yeah. Well, it may have been had you had the proper care. Had you had the proper care and the proper support and supervision, it may well have been. Because if you love it, that's the first part of it.
Yeah.
But if you don't have the support for it, it will ruin you.
No, but
there's only so much you can take before you fill up.
Yeah.
And when you fill up, you've got to have somewhere where you can go empty it all out and put it on someone else. And it counts as kind of like a pyramid scheme. Get them in, the people below just unload on the next lot,
Yeah.
I'd hate to be the person at the top there.
Just thinking that. Is he like Thanos at the top?
And that's what it's like. Everybody has always got to have their own avenue to unload what people have brought to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, you'd explode. You couldn't do it.
So what started on? So when the seed's been sown, you've had your counselling, and you thought, oh, hang on, what's going on here? I like this. So where did you go from there? What?
My next step then was I started looking into how you go about it. So I started researching on courses that you can do, and so I looked up a few, and it was because it was mostly unregulated counselling, so it's really it's a minefield, if you like, because it's unregulated, it's a minefield studying. So I looked through it, and I got in touch with my local college, because it's a proper training facility rather than someone who's teaching it in their back garden, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I got in touch with them, and it's expensive. It's expensive, and I was like, I can't really afford that. So I put it on the back burner for about 12 months, all the while thinking, I really want to do it. I really want to do it. How can I do it? Do I save up? Do I try and do it? Well, then something happened where my work, I worked for the DWP at the time, and they offered up voluntary redundancy, and it came with a redundancy payout.
Right.
And I went, how much is it? And when I worked it out that could cover my studies
right.
for the 5 years that it takes to study, because I was doing part-time. So I took the redundancy and I plowed my money into studying.
Fantastic.
So I roughed it for a few years, but I was doing something, I was suddenly doing something that I loved.
Mm.
From doing a job that I despised to doing a job that I loved, again, changed my whole mental health in a whole new way. Do you know what I mean? Rather than waking up and thinking, I really do not want to even leave the house today, to go in, I can't wait, what's today? What have we got today?
Crack on, yeah.
So I started that and I did the introduction to counselling.
Mm.
And I did that and I thought, I do, I like it.
Mm.
So then I booked into the next year, the level two, and I did that. And you start looking at yourself a little bit there and you learn a few of the skills, like listening and all that. And I thought, I am absolutely loving this.
Mm.
Did my level three, and the level three is very much about looking at yourself. And it is hard because it is digging out all them skeletons out of your closet and looking at them and poking them and seeing all these things. And a lot of people, that's when they fade away in the level three.
I did wonder whether or not there was an attrition rate from there.
It can be massive. It can be. My group that I did, we weren't, in the level three, we probably lost a third of the class doing the level three. And there was probably half of the class in the level two that decided not to do the level three.
Really?
And then on the level three, we probably lost another third, maybe half.
Wow.
From that. They've just gone, it's too much. I'm not ready, it's too much. You know what I mean? And then when you get onto the level four, that's when you are looking at yourself, but you're also having clients then.
Right.
And that's when it really starts, if you like.
Yeah.
And that's when you really realise how incredible it is.
Mm.
Nothing compares to that very first client that you end with and they turn around and go, I've run out of pain. Do you know what I mean? And that's like, whoa, that's one of the most amazing lines you can ever hear. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
I've run out of pain. And that kind of got me. And that just made me go, this is what I want to do forever.
Yeah,
this,
really.
That is it. You get the tough ones where they don't come back after one and you're like, oh my God, what have I done here?
Mm.
But them ones are worth everything. Do you know what I mean? That one, that line will stay with me forever. I've run out of pain. When he was talking about things to talk about, and after 10, 12 weeks of counselling, that was the line. He said, I'm running out of pain.
And that's gonna keep you motivated to go for the next one that you can do that for.
Yeah, and also there's no bigger privilege than somebody sharing their innermost thoughts and feelings with you. It's a privilege, you know what I mean, because these are things that people don't tell the closest person in their lives. They don't tell these things, and then they come into a room and you're a perfect stranger and they tell you everything, and it's like, whoa, there's no bigger honor than that, for someone to trust you enough to tell you the things that they won't say out loud to anyone else,
in a state of desperation as well, at the same time as well, when they're coming in. I mean, putting myself in that position, when I came in and I sat down in front of that guy and I went, right, okay, well, I've messed this up once and I can't do it again because I am on my last, you know, I was struggling at that point. I went, right, okay, I don't know where to start, so I'll start here, and it just all fell out. And then when I realised, because some of this stuff I'd never told a living soul, it all comes out, and then you piece it all back together, you pick up all the shit that you just left on the floor, and you maybe do one bit here, and then a couple of weeks later you do something else. And I ended up doing it 12 weeks it was, and I ended up coming out of that just thinking, I'm not 100%, don't get me wrong, but I am a completely different person.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, shit, I couldn't put into words how he had helped me. Do you know what I mean? But he certainly didn't say he needed that from me. He was just like, I'm very glad that you're feeling this way and whatever. But that must be such a heartwarming thing to realize that you'd help somebody, because it was written all over my face. I was a different human being when I left that.
Yeah, it is. And you'll know yourself, even from being a nurse, the buzz you can get from helping somebody in any way is a feel-good factor that helps yourself. But yeah, just knowing that you've made a little difference, do you know what I mean? And it's paying it forward. I've had it done for me. Mm-hmm. So now it's my turn to pay it forward and see if I can do that for somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
I had the very similar thing when I came out of it. I thought, yeah, I'm not 100% fixed, but as you say, I am different. Mm. And now, having spent 5 years doing the counselling and the studying and all that lot, I can honestly say now I am a completely different person. I am not even close to being that same person now.
Yeah. I certainly see a massive change in my outlook now. I certainly talk about, when I was still nursing, I still wouldn't talk about myself a lot. Mm. You know, because you don't have that kind of instruction when you do the mental health nursing. You're advised to talk about your issues and stuff, but there's no real focus on you. And I think the thing with mental health nursing is, I mean, looking back at my cohort, I can confidently say that 80% plus of the people there had a first or second hand mental health issue, either with themselves or with a family member, that they disclosed. I mean, I disclosed mine and everybody else disclosed theirs. But it like attracts like. I think I joined out of absolute curiosity because I wanted to know what made me tick, because I thought I was quite unique, because when you sit with your own thoughts forever, you're this unique little flower, and you're not, because there's so many other people experiencing the same thing. But we don't get that kind of training to deal with the us that's at the heart of that, and I think that's what people like me fall foul of later down the line.
Because I know that, like, with the person-centered case in particular that you talked about in the last podcast when you had the whole ethos is about how we are kind of two different people, if you like. We are who we really want to be and who we are. Mm. Who we really are and who we are to everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, and the further apart they are, is the more trouble you're in. Mm. Yeah. So, like putting on your bravado and people telling you you're this and telling you you're that and you believe in it. Mm. And really deep down, you don't feel that, but people have told you that, so you think you're that. And that kind of separation is...
Yeah.
It's about trying to align it and making you comfortable being who you actually are.
Yeah.
The real person that's inside, allowing them to come out and go, I'm comfortable being me. Mm. Yeah, I'm not going to be the person you want me to be, or you want me to be, or you want me to be. I'm going to be me. Mm. And once you start getting comfortable with that, it all begins to change.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that shift happened for me, I think, the first time I got signed off with depression, and because I went through a coroner's court case that was badly handled, but it just, because of lack of support, I just dealt with it all in my own head, and it just became something far bigger than it actually was, and I just lost the plot completely. Came back, and then I realized very quickly that I needed to be more honest with myself about who I was and how I was feeling. So I started speaking about feeling anxious about stuff, and that put people's backs up a little bit in certain circles. And I was just like, well, hang on a minute, we're all mental health nurses, why can't I talk about feeling anxious? You know what I mean? And then, you know, but that's by no means everybody. That we had a core of support. There's some people in there who are just absolutely spot on. But then, that salt, that level of paint, that those little flecks, they just land on you and land on you and land on, and then sooner or later you stop talking about it again, and then you start just going with the flow, and then it just gets worse and worse and worse, and then I just rebounded. And then the second time I went off, I was just like, right, this has got to stop So I walked back in and I said, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. And I lasted a year. And then I realized that it was either going to be, I was either going to go back the way I was, or I was going to have to leave, because the environment was not conducive to me being that person. And because I was more comfortable, exactly as you say, about being who I am, I couldn't do that in there.
Yeah.
So I had, so what do they say? If you can't change something, change yourself or whatever. I didn't want to change myself. I was comfortable with myself for the first time in years. So I had to change something else, and that had to go. And as much as I loved it, I don't miss it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because you feel happier within yourself now, even though you missed the work, you prefer the benefit of being who you are.
Yeah. And I don't want to be myself in spite of it. I want to be myself because I'm happy to be myself.
Yeah. You don't want it to be a downside of it.
No.
Yeah, to start having a negative effect on you. You being yourself and people then questioning you and going, oh, why are you talking about this? Why are you talking about that? And it makes you then believe. And that's where the stigma thing, it makes you believe that maybe I shouldn't be talking about this. Maybe am I just weak or something like this? Because if everyone else is coping with it so well and I'm not, why is that?
That's a huge thing, that, isn't it? Am I not as good as everybody else? But then I was in a team where there were 6 or 7 of us and 5 people had gone off with similar issues because of the type of the job, the lack of support, the underlying mental health problems, you know, all that combined, it's a melting pot that doesn't work very well. But, you know, you need those people doing that job, because you need those people with the empathy. You know, I'm sure the level of people who are drawn to counselling, I'm sure there's probably a similarly high level of people who either got a first or second hand mental health condition.
90% or higher, I would say, if not everybody is. From my experience anyway, the people that I've known throughout my training now, I'd say it's probably 100%.
Yeah.
That have been through it, even that have, 90% of them have probably had counselling themselves anyway. And the other 10% have had something undiagnosed and felt there was something there.
Yeah.
They didn't know what it was. Mm. And then it's not until they've started to go to the training and the studying and being in that environment where they've gone, I know what it is. God, I've not seen this for so many years.
Yeah.
And every single person that's finished that course now with us would tell you the same thing, that they are now different people. They are. They've changed for the better because they're more comfortable with who they are. And they don't have that fear of saying how they feel. And so much, that's society, isn't it, where they don't, nobody likes to say how they feel because, oh, well, what if somebody thinks this and what if somebody thinks that?
Yeah.
Until you get comfortable enough to think, I don't really care what somebody else thinks about it. I'm going to say it because I need to say it. I'm saying it for me, not for you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I caught myself a few months ago shying away from saying something about it when things were getting on top a little bit at work, and I was just like, no, I'm going to tell them, I'm going to say something. And you know, what do they say? Those who mind don't matter, those who matter don't mind, you know. And that's how it is. And you're absolutely right. I think the more it can become the norm, and the more it can become, I mean, if I've got a headache, I'll tell people I've got a headache. If I've twisted my ankle, people can see you limping. If you're suffering with crippling social anxiety or your depression's hitting a slump, my problem is the way I speak to my colleagues at work about it is sometimes I will wake up and I have just have a black day. It's just a black day. I feel like I'm covered in fog. And I know it'll pass because I've had it hundreds of times before. I know it'll pass, but I have to identify it to move on. Or I don't need you to do anything for me. I just need you to know that this is how it's going to be for a little while. I might be a little bit quiet or a little bit spiky, but it's not just you. I just need to get through this and it'll be fine. And most people are absolutely fine with that. But I couldn't, you know, 5 years ago, I wouldn't dream of saying that to anybody. And it's weird. And I think you're right. You're absolutely right when you say, I don't care anymore about how what people think of me. Because I'm still worried about what people thought of me. That's what was making me anxious in the first place.
Mm. And everybody that I've ever come across has dark days. They have days when they're thinking, I'm just in a foul mood today. But people don't say it because they're too frightened of saying it. Oh, I don't want to be... I don't want to be a whinger. I don't want to be weak. I don't want to be... And you're like, well, if you just do what you've said, acknowledge it, acknowledge it and go, I know why I feel this way. That's a bit of mindfulness. I know why I feel this way because it's just, I'm having a bad day. Mm-hmm. And I know that I can talk about it. I'll get through it and I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you do come out of it the other end. Yeah. When you don't do that and you sit there and you wallow in it and you hide it, and you pull it back, and then people start thinking, are you all right? Yeah. And then you think, oh, it's what's wrong with me? And you hold it in, until it becomes a big, massive thing.
Yeah, it becomes the norm. And it's when it becomes comfortable is when it becomes dangerous, isn't it? Certainly for me, anyway,
Yeah, and when you get used to it, when you get, this is how I feel now, this is my life now, this is how I'm going to start feeling all the time. Mm. And then it's like, well, what's the point? Do you know what I mean? If I'm going to feel like this every day, what's the point? I don't want to feel like this every day. This is a miserable existence.
Yeah.
And then it escalates or de-escalates, if you like, very quickly.
Yeah. This is again, going back to what you were saying about person-centered counselling before, one of the metaphors I used when I got to the point where I could articulate it was that the dark corner, the little dark corner where nobody could see me and nobody could hear me and I could hide, the shadows in there, was so comfortable to me that the idea of leaving that and not being depressed or anxious anymore was frightening, because I'm so used to having all this baggage that I feel like I have it's dysfunctional, but it's an equilibrium that I understand. And the idea of stepping out into the light and not having that anymore, I don't know how to be that person or do. And that was the most frightening thing, is leaving all that behind, or trying to leave all that behind, but having no coping skills to be able to do that.
It's terrifying. Like stepping out of that corner and being the person that you are in the corner. But, I mean, because you'd step out into the light, but you'd have to put on a mask and be somebody else, because you couldn't be that vulnerable person that's in the corner there, that's comfortable and happy being who they are.
Yeah.
So you put your walls down, you've got your armour on, and you step out into the light. And it's about stepping out of that corner, being that person that you are in the corner.
In the corner,
Step out and as that person into the light, and start being, oh, this is actually who I am.
Yeah, and that was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
But did you find that the more that you did it, the easier it got?
Yeah.
You know, you step out of it and your comfort zone expands a little bit each.
Yeah, absolutely. And most importantly, the shadow becomes less inviting. I felt less inclined to retreat back to that, because you become used to your surroundings, don't you? You find equilibrium.
Because the thing that corner had for you is I could be myself in that corner.
Yeah.
Without the threat of anything out from the outside. Whereas once you've stepped out, and it doesn't have an appeal, because it doesn't offer anything different than you've got now. I am being myself now, but I'm out in the light and I'm being myself.
Absolutely.
So I've got no need to go in the corner now. I can be me out in the open.
Yeah.
And become a functioning version of myself.
Functioning version of myself, absolutely. So do you feel that is what part of what counselling has given you as well, in that is opened your horizons to a different Carl, a different you?
It made me comfortable with who I am. Mm. It made me realise that who I am, I'm all right with.
Mm.
And accepting the fact that sometimes people are just not going to be comfortable with that.
Mm.
People aren't going to... You can't please everybody all the time. I mean, there's always going to be haters. There's always going to be issues and things that go badly for you.
Yeah.
So be comfortable with who you are. And once I felt like that, it grew over years of me doing this and working on it constantly, of being, this is me, I'm okay with me, I like me. And once you can start to say that, I'm okay, I like me, then I don't care what anyone else thinks, because the only opinion that really matters is if you like yourself, it doesn't matter whether anybody else likes you, as long as you like you. And you will draw people to you that have a similar personality to you, because they see things in you that they like.
Yeah.
And them are the friends that you really want, because the friends that actually like you.
Yeah.
They don't like the mask that you've put forward to the world. Do you know what I mean? They don't like this aspect of the false you. They don't like this aspect of the false you. They like you.
Yeah.
And then you find you've got different connections, and it's like, oh, I'm here, I'm with people being myself.
Yeah.
Wow. Do you know what I mean?
It's very liberating, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the turning point for me when I found that I was happy as myself. That realization is the biggest life-changing moment I've had in it, as being, I'm okay as me. I'm all right being me.
Yeah.
Whereas for most of my childhood, I'd always wanted to be someone else. Yeah. I mean, my poor upbringing, my colour in a predominantly white area, everything, I stuck out like a sore thumb, do you know what I mean? So I always had envy of, I want to just be that person to fit in, I want to be that, I wish we had this, I wish I had that, I wish I looked like this. And
I lived in a predominantly white area, and being white, that wasn't so much an issue for me. But I was fat, and I walked with a limp. That was my thing. That when I looked at other people, I wanted to be the sporty guy. The sporty guy had, and he probably had. He was probably riddled with deep seated anxiety. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? But to him, the archetype of him was this thing that I could never attain. So from a very young age, I didn't measure up. And then, and that travels with you, doesn't it?
Yeah, because the thing that I discovered in counselling was that I made myself who I thought whoever I was communicating with wanted me to be.
Yeah.
That's who I made myself. Mm. I mean, and so I was lost. I had no personality. I didn't know who I was. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And it took that soul searching to discover who I actually am.
Yeah.
And once you've found who you are and then become comfortable with who you are,
yeah,
it all changes. Mm. But it all came from that childhood of just not fitting in and doing whatever it takes to try and fit in. I'll try and be more like this person because they fit in, or I'll try and be more like this person because they fit in. Mm. And then when you get old enough and you get wise enough, you think, maybe I'm not fitting in because the people that are like me aren't these people. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Maybe if I am myself, I will attract those kind of people. Because you do tend to gravitate towards like-minded people.
Yeah, yeah.
And once you start becoming yourself, you do end up being surrounded by people that have a similar mindset to yourself.
Mm. Yeah.
But until you accept who you are and start being that person, you're never going to surround yourself with them. You're going to be that person that puts on 50 masks a day, depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's tiring, isn't it? That is tiring. Trying to be a chameleon to all people is not, it's not conducive to a good relationship with anybody, let alone yourself.
Mm. Yeah. So I think that's where my issue came from, is to trying to be who I wasn't instead of accepting who I was.
Yeah.
So once I started to do that, things began to change. Mm. And then you start knowing what it is and you start working on it then.
Yeah.
It's being like, well, why do I want to be like that person? Well, because, and then you go back and you think and you work on it and you go, it's because that person said that to me that time.
Mm.
And I took it. And then you tend to, when you get something, a seed sown into your mind, like a brainworm, if you like, you listen to things that reinforce it,
yeah,
and you dismiss things that contradict it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That's and when it. People, so you there saying about that, being overweight and that, like, people are saying that to you. But then when you lose weight and people are saying to you, wow, you've lost weight, and you go, you ignore that. You ignore that because you dismiss that side of it because that doesn't fit my mental image of myself. Yeah. This is how I am. And that's how a lot of clients that I have got that. They come in and they've been told, people particularly when they've been told they're no good, you're no good, you're a bad one, you're no good, you're no good. So they believe that. And then when they do something good, they don't see it as they've done something good. They dismiss it as, I don't do that because I'm not a good person.
And the praise is diluted then, isn't it? They don't hear the praise. Yeah.
They dismiss it as somebody's having a go or they're being sarcastic or it was a one-off or you don't understand it. And until you start getting people to question them, I question everything then. My own thoughts, I question them all.
Yeah, I've started being a little bit more vigilant about not accepting everything that I think.
Yeah.
Which is a tiring thing to start, but once you get into the habit of really, really being a little bit more discerning about what you believe in your own thoughts, you know, the whole mindfulness thing helped me a lot. Just the whole. Your thoughts are a river. You don't have to pick. You don't have to stand there and absorb all that water. You just dip your toe in and go. I'm dealing with that now. Move on. Just let it go.
Yeah.
And it's hard if you've not done that before. I found that really, really difficult. Not bottoming out every single thought that I have just to make sense of it, to make sure that it did or didn't affect my idea of me. Now. Thoughts can go and come and go as, you know, largely as they please.
One of the things that I question is when I say I question everything, I question thoughts about myself. When I think of myself, I question the thoughts about myself. Now, when I think I am this kind of person, I question that and go, why am I that kind of person? What is it? And then if I can find the evidence and back it up and know that, then I'm okay with that. But sometimes you can think you're something and you're not. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And then questioning it highlights it to you and you go, oh, yeah. Mm. And then you can incorporate that into your being that's not who I am. I'm not this. As you say there with being the jock, you go, but I'm that's not who I am.
Yeah.
So if I dismiss that and start focusing on what I actually like doing,
yeah,
not what I want to be, what I feel that I am.
Yeah,
focus on that instead, and then I get comfortable with how I am.
Yeah. So outside of counselling and outside of, you know, the kind of therapeutic structure that counselling offers you to, so you can maintain that good health. What else do you do outside? What's the thing that keeps you grounded? Like for me, it's origami and brewing and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think the fact that I work in where I do, I work in a drug and alcohol detox unit. And seeing other people's lives and knowing that you're not alone in issues, there are people with much worse things going, they're in much worse situations than you are. Do you know what I mean? Much worse. So I tend to take a lot from my work with that, is to see that, and the counselling as well, because that gives me the up as well. Because anyone that tells you they do counselling to help others is only telling you half the truth. Because counsellors do it to help themselves as well.
Oh, that's why I went into nursing.
Because I am getting something out of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. And if I hated it, I wouldn't do it. Do you know what I mean? So there is that little selfishness in it of, I do it because I enjoy the feeling helping someone gives me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And too many people are scared of saying that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I do it for that. So I get it from that. Mm. I like what I do, and that helps me feel good.
Yeah.
I mean, so I know it's outside of the counselling thing, but it's not the counselling that is helping me, it's the feeling I'm giving to someone else. Yeah. It just so happens that it's counselling that's giving me that feeling.
Oh, there's no, you're absolutely right. I mean, you talked about that phrase the guy said about running out of pain, wasn't it?
Pain, yeah.
Running out of pain. Like you say, that the buzz when you get somebody. I mean, I've just been reflecting while you were talking about people having certain horrendous lives. I mean, the kind of clients that you've been working with are going to be very similar to the clients that I worked with when I was in the prison. Yeah. There was this one lad, and he'd had one of the most horrific upbringings I'd ever heard. And he'd just come into the adult estate from the Young Offenders Institute, and he'd been in and out of juvie and YO since he was like 12 years old. I mean, he described himself as basically feral.
Yeah.
No, and he he came in with a file about a mile thick and all these warnings and stuff. And I don't know why I didn't do anything different to what I do normally. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I just sat down with him. I didn't even really say much. I just said, I'm just here to see if you're all right. And he just launched into this, tirade of things that had gone wrong, and I said there's not a lot I can do about that, but I picked the things I could do, and I said I can do this and I can do that and I can do that, and I'll come and see you tomorrow. So I came and saw him the next day, and immediately he'd relaxed, because up until that point, every time he got promised something, it never came. And the fact that I'd come and seen him when I said I was going to come and see him was enough for him to be much more relaxed and honest and open with me. And he ended up going to work. He ended up getting a job. You know, he ended up being a cleaner, which is a really privileged job, and all this stuff. I'm not saying for a minute that was my doing, but I think from such a small seed can come something.
And I think it was
incredible.
I think you may as well, with your thought of going, it might not be me, is probably an injustice, because if that is something that he's never had, that can be all it takes, is someone to just follow through on something that they've said they're going to do and do it. And if you've never had that, when it happens, it can be, wow, this guy actually wants to help me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I want now to be helped.
Yeah. Because people are often, it's often a preemptive strike, isn't it, with some people. You're not going to help me, so I'm not going to bother. Whereas I haven't even said that I'm not going to help them. They've just assumed I'm not going to. But there's that, and there's that trade-off where you almost have to just let things be as they are until they realise that you aren't a threat and you aren't this. And I think the advantage of being somebody who wasn't employed, I was employed in the prison, but not by the prison. I was I was a nurse in the prison, so they didn't see us, and I wore civvies as well, so I didn't wear a uniform.
Yeah.
They didn't see us as screws, in inverted commas. They didn't see us as a threat. They saw us as different people. And I think I did 2 years in drug and alcohol detox as well. So, you know, we're seen as different in certain circumstances, depending on where they are in that journey, aren't they? It's fascinating, but I think you're absolutely right. I think that you can do, even subconsciously, sometimes it is those little things, but the buzz I got when I saw him a couple of months later and he was up and about and doing stuff, and, you know, he had all these privileges and things that he'd never had in his life. And I thought, do you know what? That'll do for me. If I know that I've done that for this one guy, then that'll do for me.
Yeah, that's it. It justifies all the hard work that you do and all the stuff that you put yourself through to do it. And then you think, actually, something good has come of it. I'm okay with it. I'm happy to take on that if I'm getting just them few little snippets of positive results here and there.
Yeah.
And that's when you say, what do I do outside of it to do it? That's what keeps me going, is that. That every now and again, getting that one little bit of, oh, that was good, that's really helped me. That guy's one line there, the pain thing, that sustained me for 6-12 months, you know what I mean? Yeah. Just hearing that sustains you.
Absolutely. And it often helps you through the ones that don't go so well as well.
Yeah, because you think maybe this one just isn't the one.
Yeah.
And you know, particularly with drugs and alcohol, you learn that if you can't help everyone, some people just aren't quite ready to be helped. Yeah. No.
Absolutely.
That was what my supervision had to do with my counselling at first. The first client I had that never came back, sat with them for one session, they never came back. Mm. And it was like my second ever client. I was thinking, oh, what have I done? And I took it to supervision and I was like, I don't know. I did everything right. I did this. I thought the session went really well. And my supervisor just turned around to me and went, not everyone's ready.
No.
I mean, not everyone is ready for doing that. Or maybe that was enough for them.
Yeah.
That one session was enough. Because I'd thought it'd been brilliant. And he was a prison officer and he'd been through a hell of a time. And I sat with him and I thought, that was an amazing session. I came out of it and thought, that went really, really well. And then the next week when he didn't come back, I was like, oh no. It's my whole, have I imagined how well it went? I don't know, what have I done wrong? And then my supervisor said, maybe that was just enough. Maybe that was it. Maybe that's all he needed was for that one session to come and air it and talk it through, and then he was all right.
Yeah.
And them little things, that's what can change everything for you. And it helps my mental health as well as theirs. Do you know what I mean? Because it feels you have a purpose then.
Yeah.
That was often a thing of mine of a feeling that there's got to be more to life than this. I'm meant for more than this.
Yeah.
You know, when you feel that I'm not being utilised, I've got capacity to do much more than I'm doing right now.
Mm.
Sitting in an office, 9 to 5, doing useless work and thinking, I'm wasted here.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And then when you start exerting yourself, and you start making a difference, and you think, and you, this feels more like what I should be doing. I'm doing something now. I feel that I've got a purpose.
Yeah.
And that just having a purpose can make.
Oh, I'm made up for you, mate. It sounds like you're absolutely buzzing off it as well. It's great.
I am, yeah, it is. And it's still early doors, so there's still so much to learn. Do you know what I mean? That was one thing that I was going to say, why I picked counselling as well, was because I am the kind of person, which it took me a long time to suss this out, that once, if I'm doing a job, once I master it, once I get good at it, it loses interest for me because it's no longer a challenge. So it's like, I can do this now. And it feels like going through the motions. There's one thing about this job is you will never know everything.
No.
Ever. Do you know what I mean? You could do it for 1,000 years and you will never know everything because everybody is different.
Yeah, so somebody is going to surprise you, aren't they? Yeah.
So you can never know it all. So I know that this is something that I can put my all into for the rest of my life because I will never get to that point where I think I've mastered this now. It's pointless.
Oh, that's brilliant. I want absolute pleasure talking to you about this. Can we do this again? See how you getting on?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course we can. But of course it's always good to talk about it, and there's always more to talk about. Mm. I didn't even talk about myself really. We did. My own stuff. You think it just kind of goes out your mind, doesn't it?
Well, it's like what they say: you find a job you love, you never work a day in your life, do you? So.
And that was the thing, and that was something that, in fact, it was my sister that said to me, and she said, I'd rather be happy and poor than rich and miserable.
Yeah.
Because I'm giving up a well-paid job that I was miserable in to do something, to go back and study and be on the bones of my ass, but love what I was doing.
Yeah.
Made a difference.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that'll stay with me.
Yeah.
I'd rather be happy and poor than rich and miserable.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's a really nice point to end on.
Yep. Carl,
thank you very much, mate. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Simon. You're a star. Cheers, mate.
See you soon.
Thank you.
So that was Carl. What a chat. Really, really fascinating. I'm sure you'll agree. One of the things to preempt any questions coming from that transference, we talk about transference right near the beginning, and that can be a term that maybe you haven't heard. In a therapy context, transference refers to a redirection of a patient's feelings for a significant person to the therapist. So sometimes you would see that as anger or hatred towards the therapist in terms of transferring the person you're talking about into the person that sat in front of you. I certainly experienced that a bit when I was going through my therapy. It's often manifested as an attraction towards the therapist, depending on what you're there for. But in terms of the other way round, it's really counter-transference, not transference, that I was talking about, because it's defined as a redirection of the therapist's feelings towards a patient or a therapist's emotional entanglement with the patient. If you're talking to somebody who has issues that trigger yours, or that you then become overly emotionally drawn into that, which is entirely possible, and it's very common in therapeutic relationships, but it's just something you need to identify and talk through. This can cause problems with the therapeutic relationship. So, as we discuss at length in that episode, clinical supervision is absolutely essential in a therapeutic relationship. So, I hope that makes a bit of sense. It's not something I'm completely knowledgeable about. I'd love to hear people's opinions on transference and counter-transference. There are some controversial points in certain contrasting perspectives in transference and counter-transference, which we can go into in a later episode. So I hope that was useful, and if it's given you any insight into what it would be like to be a counsellor or go to counselling, that's fantastic. You know, if you need to get some more info, I'll see if I can dig out some links from Carl and see which route he took. So I hope that was a useful episode. And as ever, please do comment. Please do share your thoughts and suggestions at Thinking Habits on the social medias, podcast at thinkinghabits.co.uk on the email. And as I always say at the end of every episode, keep talking. And if you need to talk, you know where I am. Bye.